the origin of your interest in the field of architecture?
Oh, you want to go that far back? Well, this architecture was my thing for... it was one of those areas in which if you had some interest in drawing in those days, you know, and you weren't, and you wanted to do something practical, I think architecture was one of the fields that you could go into. For immigrants, it's very tough to go into areas where there are more debate over what's the right answer. But architecture seems to be something that's material and practical.
And did you have any early mentors? You know, I guess, in other words, in high school or middle school, how were you introduced to the field of architecture?
No, well, it was among my some of my father's friends who was at in architecture school, but they were a very minor influence, I would say.
Did you already know when you went to the University of Michigan that you wanted to study architecture, or did you come to that?
Yeah, no. I went for architecture. I've been convinced by that was the field I was going to go into, and in those days you could major in architecture, well, just as you can. I think you still do it at Howard for a 5-year architectural program.
So, in other words, you already knew before starting, you know, your freshman year that that's what you specifically wanted to study.
Yeah.
I'm just curious kind of where that resolve came from. I mean, the fact that you knew that that was definitely what you wanted to study.
Well, it turned out that I didn't know what it was turned out to be, but it turned out to be something I really liked very much. As I said, I think part of it is that, as I said, there's not a lot of choice out there. It was like, if you were good enough in math, which I was, the push was to go in engineering because that was a more practical field. So architecture was a little bit in between the two, and looked at the curriculum and looked like all the things I wanted to do anyway. It turned out to be much more complicated, much more interesting than I thought it was. But still, in those days, you didn't have a lot of choice. If you didn't like it, you tried something else.
Did you have a particular vision for what it was you wanted to do after finishing? I mean, did you have a particular goal?
No. Or? I think it's important, right, that this is 1949, 1950. Immigrants for the first time were being given opportunities to go to college. It's like before that, you know, most of the Chinese immigrants had no, even if they were good academically, there was very, very little opportunity to do something. And then once you're doing something, you don't have the luxury of changing. People would be going to the wrong professions and they have to change. But it was not like today at all. I mean, it's like, and I was lucky, it turned out to be more than I wanted to be. I mean, it was like the kind of thing that I wanted to do.
And so did you face those kinds of challenges in the classroom or early on in the profession in terms of the fact that you were one of the very few Chinese American architects training to be architect at the time?
Well, it's hard to answer that question. Let me see. There were so few minorities in my class, but I must say, in that there was no, it was a meritocracy in a way. If you did well, you could compete. And I think in a field like architecture, you just, you know, if you could do the work, you could be okay. And architects were actually at that point. With another interesting point was that there were a lot of GIs in my class, people in the GI Bill, and these people had gone, you know, gone to the, been in the war, they were more mature, and they were raised in today's terms liberal. They really looked at, you know, what you could do, and they didn't tolerate the kind of you know, racial discrimination or ethnic discrimination, and you were recognized for what you could do, not who you were. And I think architecture at that point was probably one of those fields. I mean, you probably couldn't do the same in many other fields. I don't know. I don't know sociologically why that's the case, but very important influence was the returning veterans, because they had served with all kinds of people that had been overseas. So it was very different from the America before World War II.
Would you mind giving me just a sense?
Sorry, losing you again.
Okay. Would you mind maybe giving me a sense of the chronology between when you finished at the University of Michigan and started working at the Boston Redevelopment Authority?
Okay, so when I graduated, I went to work in actually North Carolina for, I don't know if you've ever heard of Buckminster Fuller, was one of those crazy geniuses.
Yeah.
Who worked on domes and structures.
How did you get that? How did you get that opportunity?
Well, he was the kind of an itinerant teacher. He would go from school to school, and they would run projects, sometimes just 1 week or 2 weeks. And they were intensive. And again, if you could do the work, you got to do some more. So I worked on that project in school. Then I worked on summer with him in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, building a dome that was staffed by people from all over the U.S., from architecture schools. So I proved myself enough to be hired by him, and so I spent my first year at school in Raleigh, North Carolina, working on domes and structures. Okay, and then I moved to, I wasn't so completely interested in those structures as a long-term piece. So with actually having met with the people in Raleigh, I moved to New York, worked for several architecture firms, then went to got a Fulbright to go to Italy for a year. So after I got back from Italy, I worked for IMP and some other New York firms, got my license, and then worked in Boston at the Boston Redevelopment Authority, then moved to Washington, D.C. to work for a planning firm. And there I met just working on straight planning stuff wasn't interested. And I met Topper Carew, breastfeeding, and he got me interested in volunteering for the Morgan School and some other kind of local projects that he was working on and then he had connections to. And that's what led to, you know, Resurrection City and SCLC.
Before we get to Washington, I was just curious if you could say a word about working with I.M. Pei and what that experience was like and how it shaped, if at all, your approach to architecture and planning.
Well, working for Pei was very interesting because you can dash off a building, a mediocre building, very easily, actually, in building types. But the day he was meticulous in looking at how many ways you could build a building. You had to understand detailing in architectural terms that you probably know better means, how you put material together, how do you put a window in, and in order to enhance the appearance of the building. And I think I worked for him for, a couple of years. And I worked on one building all that time. Hmm. So I learned, you know, how to get in the detail into a building. But at the same time, all the projects I was working on were really big office buildings or, you know, big institutions. Yeah. And I had, ideas that I thought I would try to be more contributing to the community in some way.
Where did that desire come from of contributing?
Where did what?
Where did that desire come from to contribute?
Sorry, I'm missing your last word.
Where did that desire come from to contribute to?
Well, I think it was really growing up, you know, in Boston, in a community. I went to a high school where the academic high school, and I met people of all kinds. They were all coming from, by that time, all the Yankees had left the city of Boston. So it was all the Irish, the Italians, and the Jews. And we all lived in, probably most of us, working class communities. We understood how people lived. The idea that, you know, you could improve the city by building a highway or clearing housing seemed to us, and there was a group of us who really felt that that was a bad thing to do, and that we who were professionals, who were skilled at something, should do something about it. And a lot of that was just, in fact, I should go back one step. While I was in Boston, I became part of that group that was the anti-highway group. And looking back on it, I realized we were all first, especially the first generation that had gone to college, had become engineers, transportation engineers, city planners, architects. And we felt that we had to, that our job was both to succeed in those fields, but also to help when we could. And the anti-highway battle and working with the people in Boston who actually succeeded, they did stop the highways in Boston, certainly gave me the inspiration and that helper to be able to, again, do that kind of thing. So, you know, the first thing we picked up and I worked on was the Morgan Community School, in which we were able to save 12 houses by just moving redoing the site plan. And that The community people couldn't do that. The city people didn't want to do that. But we were able to show that we worked equally well from an architectural point of view, and also they would save somebody's house.
Can you say a word about the context in Washington, D.C. when you arrived? I mean, the efforts to fight urban renewal, particularly in Adams Morgan, when you got there. And
well, Adams Morgan wasn't an urban, Shaw was the urban renewal, the big urban renewal project. And we did a, urban design analysis of the housing, and we, as part of that, Topper did a movie. I hope you get to see it at some point. This, called "This Is the Home of Mrs. Graham," and you know, Shaw never underwent the kind of massive urban renewal that you know other parts of the city had gone through, and that was partly the times and partly the activism of Reverend Fauntleroy, you know, and worked with Reggie Griffith, who's still around.
Mm-hmm.
He was he worked with what's the name back there, Michael, MICCO was the acronym. So we were pretty much involved in that part, and. Adams Morgan was more, they were trying to build a new school. And that, you know, that involved, you know, taking a site and all that stuff.
You mentioned that you came to Washington to work with one firm in particular, and I'm just curious how you made the...
It was a planning firm. Actually didn't do architecture. They were doing more city plans, variously across the country. I worked on plans for Chicago, waterfront, Chattanooga, Tennessee. They were a firm that did plans for those cities. I lasted there probably 2 years or so before I set up my own firm because it was too routine, that kind of work.
And what was the name of that firm?
What's that?
What was the name of that firm?
Let me try to remember. Marcou, MARCOU, and O'Leary, O apostrophe L E A R Y.
And it was while working for that firm that you met Topper and started working on the Morgan Community School?
Yeah, I was working for them, and then, as I said, I met Topper at an American Institute of Architects meeting. Must have been on community issues. And then I volunteered for that, for the Morgan School and several other projects.
What do you remember about Bishop Marie Reed?
Is this Morgan School?
Yes, she was a resident of and had a church in Adams Morgan.
And she was head of the Morgan Community School
Board.
Committee, right?
Yes.
Powerful woman. What can I say? I mean, she was a presence, and she had business ideas, and she knew how to recruit people. It was a privilege to work for her.
Can you, if you happen to recall, how did the coalition of people, you know, yourself, Topper, and community residents, how did that come together?
Well, Topper was, you know, already in the community, and he, as you know, he was in architecture school at at Howard, and he had started the new thing, which was the arts, community arts center that had dance, visual arts, photography, and it was situated on 18th Street in Adams Morgan. And so we naturally came together with the bishop and other people in the community. He was in the community, so it was, and he was part of the community.
And what do you recall about the negotiation to actually move the site of the school so that the homes could be saved?
Well, it's all working through the school committee, the Adams Morgan Communities. Well, they have the local school committee, and you know they asked us to look at the site, and they asked us our opinion on the school. They wanted a new school, but they didn't also want to lose 12 houses. And actually, one of those very simple problems, very easy to solve, if the school committee were willing to make some adjustments as to orientation. They had very rigid rules about signing, and if you could relax a couple of those rules, you could actually do it. And I must say the school committee eventually did. I mean, we had some resistance from them, but they eventually agreed. And just by moving the baseball field having the ideal orientation, you moved it, you know, some 25 feet or 30 feet, you could actually do that. So that was the kind of thing that really only an architect could do. We could see instantly how to do it.
And how did you meet Ken Jaden?
Who?
Ken Jaden?
Sorry, I'm missing that.
Kenneth Jaden?
Oh, Ken Jaden.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that was Resurrection City. So, Papa and I have been working together for some time. And, in fact, I had, at some point, had an office in the new thing, which turned out to be too difficult because the African drum troupe was next door, and it made it very difficult. So I just moved next door, and SCLC had contacted Topper because the march, the Poor People's March. And 1968, I guess, was coming to D.C., and they needed a place for an encampment. So they needed a study to find out where to put the site. So they went to Topper, and Topper and I talked about it, and I recruited people I knew, which was John Rebenson, Ken Jaden, and a third person who was in LA.
Jim Goodell?
I will remember in a minute. Jim
Goodell.
Somebody. So we became the committee, essentially, both to find the site and design the shelters. By that time, there was a large volunteer group. People who were willing to work to construct. There was some money to buy materials, and essentially, I remember that Rebenson was part of the lead of the group because he was the most experienced architect and a natural leader. So he organized the group, and we actually designed those shelters essentially one evening in this house, trying to minimize construction time, how to move things under the site. And then we laid out the site itself and worked on the logistics of that. I'm sure we talked about this before, you've seen the plan, the idea of having a spine of community facilities in the middle, where to put the party, the porta potties, and so on, and where's the entry points, all the things you do when you do a site.
Do you happen to recall, Ken Jaden said that you and he were actually scheduled to meet with Dr. King the night before he was assassinated. He was supposed to come to D.C. but ended up extending his trip in Memphis. Do you recall that?
Actually, I don't recall that, but Ken probably has a better memory than I do. It's likely, I think it's possible, because I think Dr. King wanted a briefing on how the thing was laid out, how it was going to be used. And I think maybe Ken and I were the people who were available to go to that meeting. But I personally don't remember it. Hmm.
What are your memories of what happened in Washington immediately after Dr. King's assassination?
I'm sure you've read the newspaper accounts. Riots broke out everywhere. I think especially 7th Street, 14th, 8th Street Northeast. I was in Topper's office, I think, and I looked out, and we were up on the hill. We could see the smoke coming out of those three places. And I can remember distinctly walking down to Meridian Park, where it is on 16th and about Irving Street.
Mm-hmm.
There was a park that's elevated, and I went down there to look. And the city was closed down, and there were rioters coming up, I think 16th Street. And I was there, and one of the people from the new thing, one of the teenagers, came to me and said, "You're in danger here. Let me walk you out." So he took me arm by arm and walked me right past all the riders who were bent on taking their anger out on anybody who wasn't black. He walked me back to the new thing, and the whole city was closed down. I lived at that point in up Connecticut Avenue, and that day I walked home. There was no transportation.
And did you, at that time, think that the march or the Resurrection City and the campaign was going to continue, or what were the conversations about how to proceed?
Well, it was people kept coming, and it became a focus of the whole place was set up not as protest but as a point to lobby. So people who came to the Resurrection City were organized in groups to lobby Congress on issues of poverty, and as you already know, it had gone beyond civil rights. It was constant issues of the economy and the Vietnam War, and I think that everything changed after that, and the big social change that came after that sort of made Brunswick City, in some ways, became obsolete.
And do you have any memories of the day-to-day kind of construction of Resurrection City, and also during the course of the campaign itself, you know, what were you going down to the mall, or what kinds of things were you doing at that time?
Yeah, well, I think Kent probably has given you this set, but we were down there to lay out the site, essentially, you know, where the community facility was going to go, where the housing was going to go. And I remember somebody either borrowing something you lay out in the laying out a football field, the lines, striping. So we were down there with, you know, with our instruments, and all of us were down there because to lay out the, you know, where the entrance is going to be, where the fencing was going to be. And we laid it out with this you know, the thing that dispenses chalk to make goal point, you know, goal lines and so on. And we did that, spent the day doing that. And the following day, they cut the grass. And we had to do it all over again, as I remember. And then we had to be there as the supplies came in, the fencer, the porta potty, where to put things. So we were very busy at the beginning, just getting everything in the right place, and then telling people how to. The structures were very easy to put together. Once people did one, they could do the rest very easily, and then make their own variations. So after it was set up, and at least one or two of us would be on the site, pretty much because there were always questions about where to put stuff and so on. But our main work was before and laying it out.
I'm curious as to why you think. I'm curious as to why you think so many years later, kind of the story of the idea and the sort of the architectural and planning ideas behind Resurrection City have really not been, I think, given sufficient attention.
I think Resurrection City in general was considered a failure, and I think interested in it because it ended very badly. And by that time, the idea of civic action was being overtaken by much more radical forces, and, you know, the Democratic Convention, Black Power, the Panthers. I think Resurrection City was just the last piece of Dr. King's legacy, and that was unfortunate because the forces were just too huge. Both the counter forces, they just overwhelmed, you know, the legacy of Resurrection City. Now it's almost what? Is it 50 years? Yes, 50 years. Almost 50 years coming up.
Yeah.
Maybe able to look at it a little more dispassionately.
And when you reflect back on that experience, what kind of an impact did it have on you personally to work on that project and see it unfold?
Oh, it was a privilege for me to be able to do something like that. This is, you know, I think I was always looking for a balance between being community-oriented and being professional. It's one of the great experiences of my life to be able to to put together this thing. It was inspiring to be there when it was going on. The Reverend Jesse Jackson made his mark there. He was a charismatic speaker even then. And then to see people volunteer to do that, to fight for their rights, it's like you hope to do that in your life, you know?
Mm-hmm. And I'm just looking at the chronology here, and I see that in late 1968, you were working on the Morgan Community School. Do you happen to remember which kind of came first, or how those?
Oh, the Morgan School came first, I think. Okay. I think Red Flag City is my recollection. But you know, I'm not sure, because these are all things we were working on. I was, and you know, later I worked on Tacoma School as well. So what influenced my life was probably also it enabled me to have credibility to work with the Tacoma School, and then to work with other communities, which I had done, you know, over my career. So it's important. It was very important, because you know, a lot of community work, you do protests or you get something and offer something. But this is something we actually affected thousands of people.
Mm-hmm. And do you happen to remember much about the Shaw Junior High School planning process as well?
Talk about the high school again, sorry, aesthetically.
Shaw Junior High?
Oh, Shaw. Well, we did, you know, we worked with the community group. That was the time when they were exploring new kinds of layouts for the school. And certainly it was a very heady time of community people being able to participate in the design of a school. And one of the things interesting, just remember part of that process, was that I was working with a local committee on that. And it was very difficult to ask people what they want. You know, well, what would be the ideal high school for you? Because there was no such experience. And one of the things I did was to organize some field trips out in Montgomery County, you know, and asking around what were really good schools and how they were laid out, and bringing people to see them to sort of get an idea that you could do something better. As it turned out, I think it became a compromise, and you don't also overcome big social problems with the design of the school. You make your best attempt at it, but that by itself is not going to change the way the school is organized.
Mm-hmm. When do you recall the idea of a charrette kind of becoming part of your repertoire of planning kind of tools?
Well, it was, you know, all came out of working, you know, on issues with the Morgan School, with the Shaw, and then it all came together, I think, at Tacoma, where we were the second charrette in the country after Dunbar High School in Baltimore. And it, you know, it became, that first group of charrettes invented a lot of techniques that are now commonly used on how to work with communities. It all came out, you know, through both having grown up in an ethnic community and worked with Topper, and then and Morgan, and even in the Resurrection City.
What would you say you, I mean, how would you describe Topper Carew when you first met him? What struck you about him, and why did you decide to volunteer your time at the beginning to go work with him?
His afro. He had the biggest afro I ever saw in my life. No, but I was just kidding. It was that he was an architect, architecture student. He was he was very persuasive, and I, you know, watching him work, I went to visit him at the new thing. And he was working with teenagers. He was working on arts stuff. He had the ability to organize, and he had a natural way of dealing with the community. And I learned a lot from that. And then I was always convinced that you know, there's also, even in this community business, there's always people who are charlatans in some ways. They're doing it for their own good. But I think for Topper, I was always convinced that he did it, you know, as what he wanted to do, which, and then to help people directly instead of just protesting. That was important.
And what, looking back now, what are your thoughts on the new thing, just in terms of your memories or the impact that you saw it having in the neighborhood?
Again, you're fading a little.
What are your memories or your sense of the impact of the new thing center?
I don't know. It lasted a long time. I think Top is the best person to, because I asked him once, the photography group was very successful. I mean, they made really fantastic photographs. And I asked him once, what happened to the people, kids who were in that class? And I think his assessment was a few of them really did go on not to be photographers, but that it affected their lives in a way that made them able to go on. It's really, you know, it would take somebody going back and talking to people. And it may not be, you know, direct, but I'm sure it affected people really positively, because you could sort of do things. Now, again, it's a little bit like school design. You're not going to change a whole community and the whole socioeconomic structure of Americans' social structure by doing these things. But you have to do them, and they may have an effect over the long run.
I wonder if, could you say a word about the experience of working for the Boston Redevelopment Authority under David Crane? And how did that inform your approach to planning?
Well, I went to work for them at a time when it was moving away from the old urban renewal model of, you know, massive clearance, and also starting to work with communities. And again, that was an important part because there was something new. And in fact, you know, the results in, especially in Chinatown, are that we have a much more stable, solid community there because of all the sites and housing that was made possible by the renewal. I'm continuing to be active in that community, and having that housing especially, and the school and the community facilities that were built at that time, has really made the community one of the strongest ethnic communities in Chinatowns in the country. You know, compared to D.C., which has its own problems, and the context is entirely different. But D.C.'s Chinatown is, well, it will never vanish, but it's pretty much just a relic of different times.
I'm curious, did you ever get involved or spend much time in...
Yeah, speak up. Oh. Sorry, again, I'm talking David, my phone.
Did you ever get involved or spend much time in Chinatown in D.C. during your years in D.C.?
Well, my father was very active in D.C. He was head of the Lee Association, and he lived down there. And I knew a lot of the people who were down there. But I think, you know, it's just the convention center, all the stuff that's happening. They never built enough housing down there during the renewal to make it, you know, to have a solid community. So it was never that big. But it's also, I think, that actually the 68 riots actually probably had a very negative effect on Chinatown.
You said that your father was the head of the Lee Family Association. Was that the Boston chapter or the D.C. chapter? Or the
No, the D.C. He was also the, you know, he was very active in D.C. Huh. No, he lived in D.C. in fact, most of the time. He had grown up in Boston somewhat, but then he had moved to D.C. Just before the war.
And what was his name?
I can spell it for you. I use his initials, everybody knows it. It's K.L. Lee. Huh.
And so he was actually deeply involved in the D.C. Chinatown community. With the CCBA or On Yong as well, or just the Lee Family Association?
Well, he was head of the National Lee Association for a long time, mm-hmm. And you know he had well, we have roots in Boston, obviously, so he was always between the two.
And what was his profession?
He trained as a lawyer in China, but then his work was insurance. Hmm.
It's very interesting. Some of the work that we've been doing here is also on the history of D.C.'s Chinatown.
Uh-huh.
So it's... I'm very interested to learn that, you know, your father was president of the Lee Association. It's an incredibly important role, especially in D.C., where the Lees are the largest family association.
Yeah, well, they're having a current battle right now. I don't know how it's coming out. Is that they're touching the last family association that's on 8th Street. You know, their little three-story building.
Mm-hmm.
And it's real estate developers been trying to incorporate them into a larger complex and take the building and give them, you know, rights to a new space. And I think there's an internal battle going on right now. Maybe it's been resolved because I heard about it a few months ago. Whether they should accept that offer or not, or whether they should fight to keep their little three-story building there and let the developer build around it.
Do you ever get involved in D.C. Chinatown affairs, or mainly in just in Boston?
Oh, I'm not involved in D.C. at all. I hear about it because the Lee family people all talk to each other, and you know, I pick up the the scuttlebutt.
Yeah. And I'm curious, even as distant as you may be in Boston, if you have any thoughts about that predicament the predicament here in D.C. With the Lee property on H Street.
Well, I don't know much more about that than that's to say I can I can give you, I'll email you the name of a young man, or younger man, in the Lee Family Association in Boston, who is in touch with probably D.C. I don't know if he was willing to talk to you, but I'll send that to you, and you can sort of contact him directly.
Okay.
His name is Wilson Lee.
Okay, great. Thank you.
I have to run.
Okay.
Soon. So, is there any quick, if we need to continue this, we could make another time.
Yeah, maybe just one last question.
Sure.
I'm curious, when you reflect back on your time in Washington, if there are any particular lessons or values or approaches to architecture and planning that you've carried with you in the years since.
Well, not so much in that, but I think I was very well aware of how city politics affect things like planning. That is, working in Boston, we had a mayor and an old guy who was sincere about working with community. And D.C. at that point, it was appointed as that member, the chief executive of D.C. And I think it meant that you couldn't follow through in the same way that you could. Electoral politics has its if it's properly done, has its benefits. Mm-hmm. Because the D.C. government was just beyond. They had good people in the agency. You got good things done, but if not, you didn't. So.
Yeah.
Anyway, look. It was a pleasure to talk to you, and you can we can do it again, or you can email me for D.C. I'll send you Wilson's email or telephone number. Okay.
Okay, Mr. Lee. Thank you so much for making the time. I appreciate it.
Yeah. No, great to talk to you. Bye.
Bye-bye.